is Friday, June 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a somber memorial Thursday for George Floyd, infused with a call to action.
And for those that have agendas that are not about justice, this family will not let you use George as a prop.
Prominent voices are speaking out against President Trump's threats to put the military in control of U.S. cities and protesters. Also ahead, massive demonstrations across the nation are raising alarms over the potential for another coronavirus surge. It's all on today's International Edition. Hundreds of mourners in Minneapolis Thursday remembered George Floyd, the black man whose death in police custody set off a wave of nationwide protests that reached the doors of the White House and ignited a debate about race and justice in the United States. The Reverend Al Sharpton delivered an emotional eulogy.
What happened to Floyd happens every day in this country, in education, in health services, and in every area of American life. It's time for us to stand up in George's name and say, get your knee off our necks.
Sharpton also issued a fiery call to action.
George Floyd should not be among the deceased. He did not die of common health conditions. He died of a common American criminal justice malfunction.
Celebrities, musicians, and politicians were among those who attended the Minneapolis service for 46-year-old Floyd, as other states also held their own remembrances. Another night of protests in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, was overwhelmingly peaceful, a stark contrast to earlier in the week when hundreds of protesters were arrested and police used smoke canisters, tear gas, and rubber bullets to disband the demonstrators. Africa 54's Ayan Dengbior helps us understand why protesters continue to show up by the thousands.
While Washington, D.C. has seen two consecutive nights of relatively calm protests, the anger that sparked this nationwide movement is palpable.
His dream was to go to Vegas, to take his family to Vegas and live there. So he did just that as a man. And when he got to Vegas, guess what Vegas police did? Shoot him in his face, in his home, in front of his kids. He can't be just another hashtag, bro.
For this protester, who lost his brother due to police violence, and to others like Mohamed Ndoye, the demonstrations are necessary, and they're personal.
I get a handcuff on me one day.
When?
It was a couple years ago. I was driving my BMW. They stopped me, asking me, whose car is this? I was getting to the plane, and first class, they told me, you're in the wrong side. Okay? Why? Because my color.
Floyd died in police custody on May 25th. Some protesters, like Yaya C, say his death was the tipping point that forced them into the streets. But they also say they are protesting for other black people who have died by the hands of police.
It started this year with Ahmaud Arbery, a black young man just jogging. I'm a track runner. That hit very close to home because how am I supposed to go on jogs having to worry about my life? It makes no sense. As a black person in America, I feel like everyone should be very worried. And it's not just a black problem, it's an American problem.
Protester Marjan Nadari was part of a team that brought water, masks, refreshments, and solution for tear gas treatment to share with other protesters. She says it is important for her to do what she can to support fellow demonstrators.
As human beings, we have an innate sense to seek justice and bring justice to the ground. And because it's such a powerful feeling, we initially forget to care for ourselves as humans. And oftentimes we're not meeting our needs as humans. And so when we're able to step back and say, okay, in order to continuously protesting, we have to keep the momentum and give energy and give food and care for our people as one, regardless of where it comes from.
Crowds remained in front of the White House well after curfew both nights as protesters actively worked to keep the peace. Ayan Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
Well, as the protests continue in major cities across the United States, President Donald Trump has threatened to deploy military forces to American cities to crush what have been mostly peaceful protesters against police brutality. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Swora has more.
Largely peaceful protests continued in major U.S. cities where tens of thousands to express outrage over racism and police violence. Earlier this week, U.S. President Donald Trump threatened to invoke a law which would allow him to authorize active duty forces to quell protests without governor's consent. Challenging the president's threat, Defense Secretary Mark Esper said active duty forces should only be used in the most urgent and dire of situations.
We are not in one of those situations now. I do not support invoking the Insurrection Act.
Wednesday morning, Esper ordered 200 active duty soldiers to return to their home base after 2 days of peaceful demonstrations in Washington, but abruptly overturned the decision just hours later after a meeting at the White House. Esper also distanced himself from a malign visit by Trump to a church near the White House to take a picture with a Bible. After police dispersed the crowd with flash grenades and chemical sprays, the move and his overall handling of protests have hurt Trump's approval rating.
We're in the middle of social unrest as intense as we've seen since the 1960s. This is not a good atmosphere and environment for a president to run for re-election. So he's going to have to do a lot of things to get back on track and perhaps to become the front runner again, because as of today, he is not the front runner.
The unrest was triggered by the death of George Floyd, a black man who died after a white police officer pinned his knee on Floyd's neck for more than 8 minutes. All living American former presidents, including Jimmy Carter, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton, have voiced condemnation. In a virtual town hall, former President Barack Obama urged mayors to review the use of force in their cities.
That was a far more representative cross-section of America out on the streets, peacefully protesting, and who felt moved to do something because of the injustices that they had seen.
The protests have highlighted multiple systems of racial inequity in the country.
And that's connected to housing, it's connected to employment, it's connected to public schools. We often talk about public school to prison pipeline. So it's not just about sentencing or bad policing or police cameras. There's so many people out in the streets because something is fundamentally wrong and broken in the system for millions of Americans.
The charges for Minnesota police officer Derek Chauvin have been elevated to second-degree murder, defined as intentional murder that lacks premeditation. Three officers who were on the scene have been charged with aiding and abetting the murder. Patsy Whitaker-Swora, VOA News, Washington.
The American Civil Liberties Union sued the Trump administration Thursday, alleging officials violated the civil rights of protesters who were forcefully removed from a park near the White House by police this week using chemical agents before President Trump walked to a nearby church to take a photo. The lawsuit argues that Trump, Attorney General William Barr, and other officials unlawfully conspired to violate the protesters' rights. Joining us now is Joel Paul, professor at the University of California Hastings Law School. He teaches this very subject. Can the president legally order the military for the purposes that he has been saying?
No, he cannot. The Constitution doesn't allow the president, first of all, to use the military domestically, except in cases involving insurrection, which we do not have, or a foreign invasion, which hasn't occurred. There is a law, the Insurrection Act, which allows the president to use military force in certain very limited cases, the first being where he is acting in response to a request from a governor or from a state legislature, which has not happened. And the second situation is where there's been an obstruction of federal law and the federal courts, which has not occurred. There's another provision in the Insurrection Act, which has caused some confusion. It's very awkwardly worded, but basically what it says is that if the president is using the military under one of these prior circumstances, he can use it to suppress domestic violence only to the extent that it's necessary to protect people's civil rights under the Constitution or to avoid an obstruction of federal law. Well, there hasn't been an obstruction of federal law, and there hasn't been any attempt that I know of by any crowds to prevent the enforcement of people's civil liberties. So none of those seem to be appropriate.
Would that include when we saw the fires burning and the looting and the violence?
The vandalism which has occurred in a number of cities is, of course, criminal and is a violation of state law or local law. It's not a violation of federal law, and there hasn't been any obstruction of the federal courts. So the president really can't use the military for that purpose.
What if he puts out the order anyway, given that this president doesn't always follow protocol or things of that nature?
That's an excellent question. The Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, which was adopted after the end of Reconstruction in the South after the Civil War, in order to actually prevent the federal military from enforcing the civil rights laws that had been passed by Congress to protect African Americans. That act, the Posse Comitatus Act, actually makes it criminal for anyone to use the military to execute the laws, and it actually imposes fine or criminal sentence. Now, I don't expect anyone's going to actually use that provision to try to bring a criminal indictment against the president, but it does stand as a warning to anyone in the military, for example, a general or someone at a lower rank who tries to follow the president's orders, that they would actually be in violation of the Posse Comitatus Act. Now, do I think that the Supreme Court of the United States or the federal courts as presently constituted would enforce the law? I don't know, but that is the statute.
What you've seen so far in what happened in Washington a few nights ago when the president made that walk to a nearby church and peaceful protesters were violently cleared out. What about the legalities of all that?
That's a special circumstance. The District of Columbia, because it's a federal enclave, is subject to the president's control over what would otherwise be the D.C. National Guard.
That was Joel Paul, professor of the University of California Hastings Law School. As large crowds gather amid protests in the United States, concern is also growing that the coronavirus will spread, creating more clusters of infection as states reopen their economies. VOA's Kane Farabaugh spoke with several medical experts in Illinois, where civil unrest and protests forced coronavirus testing sites to close in some communities, further hampering efforts to monitor the spread of the virus.
As he watched unrest unfold across the United States under lockdown from his home office in Chicago, the director of Northwestern University's Institute for Global Health, Dr. Robert Murphy, began to wonder if everyone had suddenly forgotten the country was dealing with a dangerous pandemic.
COVID doesn't care about politics. It just likes to jump from person to person. So you're putting yourself at risk.
It was a message Chicago's mayor, Lori Lightfoot, echoed in her daily address to the public on the same day she moved ahead with plans to loosen restrictions in the city in place since March to prevent the spread of the coronavirus, despite continuing unrest.
That risk is real. It is present, and it will be with us for the foreseeable future. And you need to take the precautions, not only just to protect yourself, but for others in your network, in your home, that you care about. Because now you are at heightened risk of COVID-19.
This is just setting us backwards. So instead of being able to control the virus like we had hoped, now it's either going to plateau, maybe go up a little bit, but whatever it is, it's pushing us way down the timeline.
The risk of increasing violence and destruction led the Illinois Department of Public Health to temporarily close community COVID-19 testing facilities, delaying notifications of positive test results and interrupting the medical community's ability to track the virus's spread.
It'll obviously go down because we're not testing as many people. People are afraid to go out. You can't even get anywhere near the downtown. There's flare-ups all around the city. So, you know, people, they're staying home now more than ever.
When the gatherings subside, Rush University Associate Professor of Medicine and Infectious Disease, Dr. Michael Lin, says testing will likely return to pre-protest levels, if not increase. But understanding how the recent unrest in the U.S. will impact the spread of the virus won't be immediate.
If there's any spike, it may happen you know, sometime about a week or 2 weeks after the gatherings. And that's usually about the time it takes for the infection to incubate, manifest symptoms, and become severe enough so that people end up needing hospital care.
But Dr. Lin offers a glimmer of hope that virus spread might be limited among protesters.
Because we know that a lot of spread tends to happen in indoor areas where there's poor ventilation. In the outdoors, with the air blowing around, there may be less risk of spread. With the sun being out, you know, UV rays can actually also kill the virus. But when it comes to transmission, it's really difficult to predict.
Video of demonstrations show widespread but not universal use of masks that can limit the expulsion of germs in the air.
So it only works if everybody is wearing a mask.
As the number of coronavirus infections in the U.S. nears 2 million, some Americans are weighing health risks while exercising their right to demonstrate. Meanwhile, polling data continue to show clear majorities view curbing COVID-19 as a priority. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
The challenges faced by African nations during the coronavirus pandemic are about much more than a rapidly spreading virus, according to American aid officials. They're growing increasingly concerned about the threats it poses to proper nutrition, the economy, liberties and freedoms, and the ongoing war against a deadly parasite that has plagued this continent for centuries, malaria. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The U.S. has put in more than $1 billion towards helping other countries fight the coronavirus pandemic. By State Department estimates, more than a quarter of that money has gone to the African continent. And in 2019, the U.S. Agency for International Development and the State Department added another $8.3 billion of assistance to 47 countries. That may seem like a large sum, but USAID's Senior Coordinator for Africa, Christopher Runyon, enumerated the challenges they have to cover with those funds, especially amid predictions that a viral spike is on its way for African nations.
Our primary concerns in Africa now are responding to the disease, the food security issues and disruptions in access to food, economic and employment impacts in Africa, and concerns for democratic backsliding and the loss of progress in other development sectors. On health response, we may not yet have seen the potential height of an outbreak in sub-Saharan Africa. Weak health system capacity, urban density with poor sanitation, and other challenges make Africa particularly vulnerable to a large-scale outbreak.
And says Dr. Kenneth Staley, USAID's Global Malaria Coordinator and leader of its COVID-19 task force, there is another killer on the loose. According to the World Health Organization, malaria kills about 400,000 Africans each year. He says health workers and officials are doing all they can to keep up the fight against malaria.
We're trying to ensure that all of our services are maintained during this time. As with many other crises, the challenges we see are very similar. So first of all, we see effects with our supply chains. We need to spend more time and think more about how we can get active pharmaceutical ingredients, for example, all the way to making sure that our medicines can reach the last mile. Then the third point, in terms of quantifying impact, we've seen about a 25 to 30% increase in our costs. To put a price tag on it, our estimated increased costs at the moment are about $120 million. And so I think the malaria coordinators in each country, as well as international partners, are going to great lengths to think through how we can adapt our delivery of care in the COVID-19 environment.
So far, the virus has killed about 2,800 people in Africa, according to WHO reports. In the U.S., 105,000 people have died. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Kenyan authorities have charged a police officer with murder for the shooting death of a teenage boy while the officer enforced a coronavirus curfew. Rights activists say Kenyan police use of excessive force during the pandemic has been among the deadliest in the world. Kenya has reported 74 deaths due to COVID-19, but rights groups claim police have killed at least 26 people while enforcing measures aimed at stopping the virus. April Zhu reports from Nairobi.
Kenya's Independent Policing Oversight Authority, or IPOA, on Thursday announced a police officer was being charged with murder in the shooting deaths of Yasin Hussein Moyo. The 13-year-old boy was standing on the balcony of his parents' home in Nairobi on March 30th when he was hit by a bullet as police enforced a nighttime coronavirus curfew. Jonathan Ludumpui is vice chairman of the Policing Oversight Authority, a civilian group established to investigate and audit police misconduct. He says more officers have been disciplined, but he would not disclose how many.
They have really been disciplined. Some of them have been recalled, some of them have been addicted, and some certain disciplinary action or role models have already been preferred against others.
The IPOA said Thursday that five other police officers were facing charges over other deaths, shootings, and assaults that predated Kenya's curfew. In a statement earlier this week, the oversight body said 15 deaths linked to police during the curfew are under investigation. But rights groups say since Kenya's curfew began March 27th, police are responsible for at least 26 deaths, the vast majority in poor neighborhoods. Juliet Wanjira is secretariat of the Mathare Social Justice Center, an organization that documents extrajudicial police killings. She says charges brought against officers have not led to fewer civilians being killed.
Arresting the killer of Yasin Moyo is not going to bring Yasin Moyo back. It's not going to. What is justice really? Justice is preventing more Yasin Moyos from being killed. And that is what we need IPOA and this government to do.
Public anger is beginning to boil over. Video on social media showed protesters defying the curfew Monday night in Nairobi's Mathare slum and setting tires on fire in outrage over the shooting death of an elderly homeless man. The protesters accused Kenyan police of killing the man, whom locals called Vaite, while enforcing the curfew. Speaking to Kenya's NTV News Tuesday, Kenya police spokesman Charles Ubino claimed that Vaite was shot not by police, but by men on motorcycles.
If any police officer, including myself, if I take law into my hand and I kill someone, you will not need to expose it. I'll be taken to court.
The Police Oversight Authority says Vaite's death is one of those being investigated. The IPOA says 87 complaints of police violence have been lodged since the curfew, including shootings, robbery, and sexual assault. The executive director of Amnesty International Kenya, Irungu Houghton, says the spike in cases shows that not enough disciplinary actions are being taken.
If you continue to retain a veil of secrecy around both the disciplinary actions that you're taking and the officers that are being disciplined, then essentially what you are sending as a signal to the other officers is that they can continue to do what they're doing and that there will be no consequences.
Kenya's prosecution of police officers is exceedingly rare. Since its establishment in 2012, IPOA has convicted only 7 police. April Ju for VOA News, Nairobi.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. One of the white men charged in the Georgia killing of Ahmaud Arbery used a racial slur after shooting the unarmed black man. That from an investigator testifying in court on Thursday in another case that has been roiling race relations in the U.S. Prosecutor said Arbery had been chased, hunted, and ultimately executed. The chief magistrate judge ruled probable cause existed for the case to go to trial. Police pepper sprayed some Hong Kong protesters Thursday who defied a ban to stage candlelight rallies in memory of China's bloody 1989 Tiananmen Square democracy crackdown. Demonstrators accused Beijing of stifling their freedoms. Israel's intention to annex parts of the occupied West Bank is being challenged by Jewish settlers who might have been expected to cheer the plan promoted by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu under a U.S. peace blueprint a month before the proposed expansion of Israeli jurisdiction is due to be discussed by Netanyahu's new unity government. Some settler leaders have resorted to rhetoric likely to embarrass him at the White House. Stay with VOA for all the latest. A new United Nations report accuses the Philippines government of waging an illegal campaign against suspected drug users in which thousands are being killed and arbitrarily arrested with impunity. The report, released by the UN Human Rights Office Thursday, calls for justice for the victims and for perpetrators to be held accountable for their crimes. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
This hard-hitting report sets out in stark terms the devastating toll the government's war on drugs has taken on the Philippine people. It says the government's focus on countering security threats and illegal drugs has resulted in widespread and systematic killings of thousands of alleged drug suspects and human rights defenders over the past 5 years. According to official government figures, more than 8,600 people have been killed. But the UN Human Rights Office estimates the real number to be at least three times higher. Yet during this time, it notes only one policeman has been convicted of killing a drug suspect. The main author of the report, Ravina Shamdasani, says key policy documents relating to the campaign against illegal drugs lack legal protections. She says they also contain troubling language, such as negation and neutralization of drug suspects.
And while these terms are not specifically defined, when you couple the use of such ominous language with the kind of high-level rhetoric calling for the killings of suspected of drug offenders, we find that this may amount to a permission to kill. This may be interpreted by police as a permission to kill.
The report finds police routinely make house arrests without warrants. It says there's evidence of police cover-up of killings of unarmed victims. It says most of the victims of the illegal drug campaign appear to be men from urban communities living in poverty. But Shamdasani tells VOA that data about how many people have been killed and who they are is very limited.
What their socioeconomic backgrounds were, you know, the gender, the where they lived, and even whether they were users of drugs or involved in the drug trade, for example. Now, our position is clear. People who use drugs or sell drugs do not lose their human rights. In fact, the UN advocates for the decriminalization of the possession of drugs.
The Human Rights Office says it shared the first draft of the report with the government last week. It says the government provided a number of substantive comments, many of which have been incorporated in the report. However, it adds there's been no official response since the report was released. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Finally today, given chaos in the U.S. and elsewhere around the world amid a global pandemic, violence, turmoil, racism, we leave you with a message of hope. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. We both thank you so much for listening. Take care, and please be well.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Dante, AU, African Youth, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.